All right, and our next speaker is going to be Dr. Christine Cho, talking about environmental emergency.
I promised I'd put the poem back up, so I'm putting the poem up. It'll be in the electronic syllabus. I have nothing to disclose. So we're going to talk about various topics today, describing electrical injuries and their characteristics, thinking about poor prognostic indicators of submersion, thinking about different heat-related type illnesses, and different degrees of hypothermia. So we're talking about environmental emergencies. To start, electrical injuries, we're going to talk about AC and DC, AC-DC. Next time I'll put a little audio AC-DC in there. AC, alternating current. So that's the kind of current that you have power in your buildings. AC, because of the alternating nature of the current, has the possibility of tetany, and that's important to remember. There's lower voltages, like minor household things, 110 to 240 volts, higher voltages, and then there's power lines, which are extremely high, upwards of 100,000 volts. If somebody has a minor household AC injury and they are asymptomatic in front of you, the routine recommendation is no labs, that they can be discharged, nothing necessarily needs to be done. There are some cases where you might be concerned about a higher voltage AC injury, and if there is loss of consciousness for some reason, maybe tetany, where they are holding the current in some way and it's kind of going off and off and on and they're holding on to it. If there was wet skin and if there was potentially flow through the heart, these are things where you may consider doing some more tests and lab findings, using labs. Direct current is one that does not go off and on. That's what you find in batteries, but also in high voltage power lines and whatnot at times. Sometimes that's AC as well. The DC, because it's a single muscle contraction in a high voltage scenario, would give you a throwing kind of blunt injury, and that's what you'd be as concerned about, as well as the internal kind of effects of the current. So concerned about blunt injury because of the throwing of the victim, as well as worrying about cardiac dysrhythmias. Occasionally, if there's an electrical arc, you can have a high temperature with a deep thermal burn, and as we had in the earlier morning conversation, the location and the outward symptoms of the injury don't necessarily reflect anything that's more deeper in. This is always a very hot topic board review question. So if a child bites an electrical cord and they get an oral burn to the mouth, remember that that oral burn is at high risk for rebleeding 7 to 10 days later. Think about like post-TNA. There's a labial artery, and later on they may come in with vigorous bleeding, and that's something that they need to really look out for. Lightning, which, you know, occasionally can occur. It does flow over the body, not through the body. Cardiac arrest obviously could potentially be a problem with lightning injuries. The thing, the little pearl I wanted to leave with you was that because of the respiratory center being affected, CPR should be continued longer in the lightning injury. I don't know exactly how much longer, I'm sorry, but it takes longer to recover, so you may go a little longer with that if there's a suspected lightning injury causing a CPR arrest. The picture... good, it came out pretty well. Also called coronagraphic marking, there's a ferning pattern, so if you see this, this is what is very pathognomonic of a lightning injury on the skin. Also called a Lichtenberg figure. Submersion injuries. So suffocation by submersion or immersion in a liquid substance. There's no longer dry drowning, wet drowning, it's all just submersion injury, drowning. It's the second leading cause of injury in people aged 1 to 14 years of age. You have to worry about bathtubs, unfenced swimming pools. And as you all know, there's two peaks of incidence. There's a toddler age range where it's an accidental, hopefully accidental, or some sort of unintentional neglect in a bathtub situation. And then there's the older teenage range where intoxication is something that you want to be concerned about because they fell and had some sort of injury into a body of water. Things that would be prognostic for poor outcome for submersion injuries include submersion that's longer than 25 minutes, a resuscitation that takes longer than 25 minutes, hypothermia in the patient when they arrive. The only exception would be something where dead cold winter icy water submersion, not a cool pond somewhere. Obviously, if they're unresponsive and if they're having CPR when they're in the ED by the time they arrive, and if there's hyperglycemia. These are some factors that have predicted poor outcome in submersion injuries. So some pearls to treating submersion. This is very similar to kind of the routine care that you give, starting with ABCs, dextrose monitors, assessing the temperature and removing the clothing and drying the patient, because that it's just like a newborn baby, right? Their wetness is getting them colder as they sit there, and treating the hypothermia. Don't forget C-spine stabilization, especially if it was some sort of pool injury. You're not sure if it was kind of diving in a teen situation. You don't know what kind of potential injury could have been to the neck. You're going to think about drug intoxication, think about child abuse potentially for a toddler age range or a baby. Switching over to heat-related illnesses, the important thing to remember about heat-related illness is that it's a spectrum of illness. So it's not just this is one thing and then, you know, at this next degree temperature it becomes this. And everywhere from heat exhaustion all the way to heat stroke follows kind of a slow progression. And you may be somewhere in the middle there, but thinking about that as kind of a slow progression over time or with the time in the exposed to the heat source. A very mild injury that's important to think about is heat cramps, which is not necessarily on the heat exhaustion, heat syncope pathway. These are people who are usually acclimatized to heat. And the problem in heat cramps is that they have significant salt loss. So they're sweating, and they're drinking water, and they're drinking tons of water, and they're staying well hydrated. So they will not look dehydrated in front of you. And in fact, it's the typical case is that some kid has been out, you know, in heavy football practice, sweating up the wazoo, drinking tons of water, and then when they get home and they're resting, they have severe cramps. And what happens is they have significant salt losses, and that is what's causing them to cramp up. So in mild cases, some oral, you know, salts, you know, have some pretzels and drink lots of water, eat lots of pretzels and kind of stay hydrated. But if they are more moderate or severe in front of you, then they may need normal saline to replenish their salt, not necessarily the fluid. Again, they're not going to look dehydrated, as opposed to thinking about other heat-related illnesses such as exhaustion and heat stroke, where they would be potentially dehydrated. And then the way to prevent that is making sure that people are eating or drinking enough electrolytes as they are also losing a lot of fluids. And although, you know, Gatorade and those types of solutions have some electrolytes, we know that they're not exactly the same as salt. You know, if you ever licked your arm while you're exercising or by chance done that, I'm not recommending that, of course, then you know that sweat can be quite salty. And so it's important to remember that there's a significant amount of electrolyte loss, and that would be something to be worried about. It's important to also know that compression and benzodiazepines in this case are not going to necessarily help your symptoms. It's really the salt replenishment that's necessary. It's kind of like a seizure because of hyponatremia. You can give Ativan all you want, but probably what they need is sodium. So other minor heat illnesses that we're going to review, there's heat syncope and there's also heat edema. Heat syncope, you would kind of be concerned that potentially there's something that's a more severe, but this is just someone who's an unacclimatized who has syncope, and basically they, because they're having vasodilation and they might be slightly dry, that they have a syncopal event. Heat edema is cutaneous vasodilation in the skin causing just edema. I mean, who doesn't get that when they're walking around all day when they're out somewhere super hot? In heat exhaustion, you're going to think about dehydration and some more milder symptoms when you're thinking about the spectrum of exhaustion all the way to stroke. Headache, malaise, maybe some nausea and vomiting. In this case, there's not going to be any organ dysfunction per se, but they're having kind of a sicker appearance in front of you. Their temperature can be up to 39 degrees for heat exhaustion, and in general what they're doing is trying to reduce their core temperature by peripherally vasodilating. This is, like I said, on the precursor to heat stroke. Heat stroke, on the other hand, is life-threatening. This is someone who's coming in front of you with showing end organ damage as they've had heat exposure. Their temperature is usually greater than 40 degrees. They have severe dehydration, altered mental status or coma, and they may or may not have sweating because they've gotten to the point now where they've sweated it out and exertionally, they may have sweating, but in classic heat stroke, they're just hot and dry, greater than 40 degrees, and again, showing signs of end organ dysfunction, whether that be their mental status, their neurologic status, or the rest of their body by lab function tests or the way they're looking on your monitoring. So you may see signs on lab tests of DIC, end organ failure, renal failure, liver failure. They may come in with seizures. They may have rhabdomyolysis, and they may even be having arrhythmias. Tests that you may use in a patient with heat stroke in front of you, you may be doing CBCs, COAG tests. You're going to look at electrolytes, BUN, creatinine, other electrolytes as well, thinking about LFTs, CK, urinalysis if you're worried about rhabdomyolysis. And if they are obtunded, you may be also using a head CT, not exactly for the heat stroke itself, but also if there's any sort of comorbid factors. So they're super hot. The treatment for that is, remember to make sure that you're monitoring the temperature continuously. You may need some sort of bladder or esophageal probe to have a continuous temperature monitoring, starting with fluids because they are dehydrated, saline boluses, and then thinking about active cooling. So ice packs to the groin, to the axilla. This is the environmental emergency in the emergency department. An EVS stat to the ED. We need the big fans. And you spray them with water on the skin so that there's evaporative cooling loss as you fan them as well. And then you're just going to treat the other symptoms as you would with any other patient. If they have signs of rhabdo, lots of fluids, seizures as necessary, benzos as necessary, and then DIC. All right, flipping to hypothermia. I went fast. There's several degrees of hypothermia, and the temperatures obviously are very fake in the sense that they just pick numbers, but they are generally kind of the categories that you're going to think about and certainly memorize for different board questions. So when you have mild hypothermia, that's going to be 32 to 35 degrees. Your symptoms will be shivering, vasoconstriction, mild symptoms, okay? Moderate, 28 to 32 degrees Celsius, you're going to actually start to have decreased shivering. You may have some signs of altered mental status, and you may have some dysrhythmias in that range. There's a classic teaching of a J wave, which is a positive deflection after the QRS that may be associated with hypothermia that you may see in hypothermia. However, it's also a very nonspecific finding. You may see it in other kind of states as well. So it's not necessarily only pathognomonic, but you may see that in a hypothermia state. And that's where the green arrow is, a little positive deflection after the QRS. That's called the Osborne wave. Severe hypothermia, less than 28 degrees Celsius, you're not shivering at that point. You may be unconscious. You may be having ventricular fibrillation or asystole. You're quite rigid. You may have flushed skin, and you may have fixed dilated pupils. And then, of course, you're going to try to use a cold-specific probe because most temperature regular thermometers aren't necessarily sensitive or made to detect temperatures in that range. So when you're in the mild temperature range, you're just going to use passive rewarming. But when you're in the moderate to severe, either less than 32 or less than 28, you're going to think about active rewarming. So bear huggers, heated lamps, hot packs, heated IV fluids, warmed oxygen. And if necessary, although I would say this is a quite aggressive way of doing it, peritoneal lavage, gastric lavage, bladder lavage, thoracic lavage, and potentially ECMO. Again, these are much more for a severe hypothermia, unresponsive or needing these other, not responding well to the other measures that you're doing. Again, remembering that if there's cold fluid, like if they're from a submersion or any kind of cold liquids to the body, to making sure that they're being dried off as well. You're going to actively rewarm just till 32 degrees. And your goal is actually a slow rewarming, which it's very hard to take someone who's from core temperature, very cold, to quickly rewarm them. But knowing in the back of your mind, it's okay that it's only going 1 to 2 degrees at a time for an hour. You don't have to think, oh, my goodness, in 5 minutes I have to get three boluses in and blah, blah. It's a slow temperature rewarming is the ideal goal for hypothermia treatment. So when you have moderate to severe hypothermia, you're thinking about D-stick rapidly, a chem panel, and then kind of end organ things, lipase, a CBC, coags. You're going to do a blood type and cross match if necessary for transfusion later, checking an ABG. You may need additional studies for hypothyroidism. For example, if there was no actual exposure to cold and you're thinking that might be a metabolic defect, you might be thinking about thyroid studies or pituitary studies in some young infant who has not declared itself to have an endocrinologic abnormality. You're going to think about infection in the more mildly hypothermic patients and also about intoxication, especially if they were found out somewhere altered and down in a cold area. An important concept to remember, also a very kind of hot topic board question, is the concept of afterdrop. And this is clinically relevant as well. As you're rewarming somebody in the department who has hypothermia, you want to know to expect this and not feel dismayed when they start having a decrease in their core temperature as you start to rewarm. So if you're thinking about active rewarming measures that you start with blankets and bear huggers on the skin, that's going to cause vasodilation. And then what happens is, because of that, you may have an initial drop in your core temperature before you're able to start to increase your temperature. And so that's the phenomenon of afterdrop. Another key point is that there are high risks for arrhythmias during hypothermia, but their body is very unresponsive to medications during resuscitation. So things such as epi and lidocaine, antiarrhythmics, should be reserved to be used until after the patient is about 30 degrees Celsius. So if they come in severe hypothermia, less than 28 degrees, you just start with rewarming, regardless of the fact that they have asystole. Once they're higher than 30 degrees is when you can start your medication such as epinephrine or do defibrillation because of VFib. So it sounds a little counter that you're sitting there with someone who's very cold, 26, 28 degrees, and they have asystole and you're not giving medications, but they won't, the body won't receive those medications. And if you're giving multiple doses of epi when they're 28 degrees, once they start becoming warm, all of that medication is going to suddenly have a surge and potentially have an effect at that point that you didn't want to have. If they're asystolic because they're hypothermic and that they were going to start to regain cardiac function as they got warmer, all that epi that you might have given during that time is not necessarily what you want to have an effect as they get warm. So usually around 32 degrees and higher is when you're considered kind of conscious from your from the temperature standpoint. So when we say you're not dead till you're warm and dead, you're not cold and dead, you can stop resuscitation once you get to 32 degrees centigrade and for 30 minutes time. Okay. Sometimes people ask questions, well, what if someone arrives and they're hypothermic, but they're hypothermic because they died and then they became hypothermic? And that's always a little bit of a tricky scenario. I think that a lot of it has to do with your history as well. Someone who is in their home potentially doing nothing that would have necessarily exposed them to be cold is unlikely to have been depressed because they were hypothermic. But at the same time, you know, if they are 28 degrees and there was some sort of exposure, or if they're less than 32 degrees and there is some sort of exposure, there is some value in potentially thinking about rewarming them before you actually call the resuscitation. Some other cold illnesses that, I always love chilblains, perineo, I just like the word, but it's important to think about these as well, especially when you're, both when you're caring for patients, but also for board level questions. Chilblains, also called perineo, is local inflammation and damage to the capillaries. It's going to be because of prolonged cold vasoconstriction in the extremities and itchy red patches with swelling and blistering and pain upon rewarming is a common phenomenon. A trench foot is the non-freezing cold injury. There's a pre-hyperemic phase where you have blanched skin and no blisters, but the skin is numb. And then after rewarming, there's a hyperemic phase where it's red, painful, swollen again, blisters, sometimes petechiae and blood blisters. And then there's a post-hyperemic phase where you have hyperhidrosis, lots of sweating. So frostbite has also levels. There's frost nip. Just like a cute little frostbite, like the baby frostbite. Mild, red, cold, prickling, numbness. It's not permanent. We've probably all had it, especially if you're in San Francisco in July. It's pretty freezing there. Superficial frostbite So when your fingers are white or your extremities are white and pale, and as they rewarm, and they can be slightly blue as well. As they rewarm, they burn because of the rewarming, and you may have blistering on rewarming, and that would be indicative of more of a superficial frostbite. A deep frostbite is when it's through all the layers, you lose sensation. There can be very large blisters as they rewarm, and your fingers or extremities could also be very black and hard. Ugh. So for a summary of some of the topics we went over the AC current for mild injuries, how that doesn't need necessarily any kind of laboratory or workup evaluation in the emergency department. However, if there's a high voltage current injury, you might be concerned, especially if there was a history of tetany with that exposure. High voltage direct currents, you're worried about blunt trauma in addition to the potential internal damage and dysrhythmia that may come with that electrical injury. And then don't forget about the 7 to 10 day post bleed of the labial artery in someone who bites a cord. Heat-related illnesses, we talked about heat cramps, which is all about salt. Fluid is fine in heat, fluid status is fine in heat cramps, but the salt is depleted. You can have mild heat injuries where it's syncope, edema, or just mild heat exhaustion. And then there's severe heat stroke where you have altered mental status, end organ dysfunction, and temperatures of greater than 40 degrees. Cold-related illnesses, you're going to worry about after drop so that the core temperature may initially drop when you're starting to rewarm. I can't believe I did this. Okay, and so I wanted to make a little mnemonic song for you about hypothermia because it's really hard to remember. I can't believe this. The different degrees. Okay. All right. 32, 35. It's mild, so you'll likely survive. 28, 32. Active warming, cause you're altered and blue. 28 and down, severely frown. Wait till 30 before any EpiMed gets you 32, cause you can't be cold and dead. I know the fellows will appreciate it because, you know, you're like memorizing a trillion facts, so I hope you appreciate it and I hope you can think of it while you're taking your boards. Thank you.
All right, another exceptional morning, exceptional lectures, and exceptional singing, indeed. That's exactly right.
Talk about raising the bar.
For those of you, exactly, next year it's going to be an operetta. It's the entire thing is going to be sung. For those of you purchasing the audio recording, there's going to be a little surcharge for the Disney thing that we have to offer them. So, all right, excellent question. So let's just start. Why don't we start with Dr. Nelson? We have a bunch of questions here about wounds. And can you talk a little bit about the irrigation of wounds and potentially the issues with making things worse by putting more pressure.
Yeah, there were a few questions about someone said, I'm worried my techs are using too much pressure. It is possible to irrigate wounds with too much pressure. It's hard unless you're actually watching them because techs tend to be really strong people in my ER. Many of them are training as paramedics, and they have big muscles. And it is actually possible to dissect tissue planes. You don't really want to introduce bacteria where they haven't been injected. Also along the lines of, but you want to wash vigorously. There is actually a question, I think it was on that same card, about can you theoretically wash with tap water? And studies have been done with showing equivalent rates of wound infection, this is in just general lacerations in general, by just sticking the person's limb underneath flowing tap water and letting enough water wash into the wound, and no increase in wound infections has been noted and appears equally effective as irrigation with sterile saline. That study was not done with animal bites, however. So I assume that with our irrigation devices, you will have a little more control about getting fluid at the right pressure in the little nooks and crannies of the wound. But if you didn't have any other way of doing it, you can irrigate wounds with tap water. It just doesn't look real medical. And when people get the big bill, they're wondering, oh, you know, I could have done that at home. You know, so then there's the whole placebo effect of using an irrigation device.
Okay, that's absolutely true. Judd Nelson, I'm sorry, Judd Nelson, you know, from Don't Forget Me fame.
Breakfast Club.
Breakfast Club, thank
Breakfast
you.
Club, Judd.
So, Judd Hollenbeck? Hollander, thank you. Geez, wow. I need more coffee. He did a lot of those studies looking at that stuff. And in terms of you don't need sterile fluids, you don't need sterile gloves, but that does take away some of the drama of that process. And
on TV, they get sterile.
Exactly, right. Gowns, gloves,
you know.
Washing. Who washes their hands before? I mean, that's just crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. Exactly. Dr. Anderson, can you talk to us a little bit more about pulse oximetry and methemoglobinemia, and then also about methemoglobinemia, you know, methemoglobinemia. Is there a certain percentage at which they deserve treatment with methylene blue?
Yes. So in terms of the percentage, you start looking blue when your methemoglobin level is about 15%. So that means when 15% of your hemoglobin is in the ferric form, you'll at least look a little blue. You don't necessarily have to treat them until you get about 30% methemoglobin. You will find every now and then you'll get, particularly the newborns, because those are the ones that tend to get us in the most trouble, but old people can do it too. You know, if I drink enough of something crazy or I give somebody enough lidocaine, I can make an adult person be blue too. But for the little guys, there was actually a couple of studies, one particularly out of France, I think, where they had this diarrheal epidemic thing of newborns. And so what happened was that all these kids were coming into the ED kind of sort of dusky, their lips were like just a hint blue, and they were getting these methemoglobin levels that were coming back at like 14, 15, 16. The kids were looking kind of crappy, but not totally crappy. And what was happening is when you have diarrhea, what do you poop out? You poop out a lot of your bicarb, right? And so you get a little bit acidotic. Remember, in order, when we eat a carrot, in order for us to not be blue, we need that methemoglobin reductase to make us go back to pink again. Well, when you're a little bit acidotic, as you might get when you have diarrhea, that methemoglobin reductase doesn't work as well. And so these little kids were coming in, these infants were coming in just from having diarrhea, getting methemoglobinemia from just, you know, normal oxidation of their hemoglobin. And so if you have a kid who's not, you know, they're not going down the tubes, they don't look absolutely horrible, but they're that kind of sort of, and they got a little bit of a level, generally if you just hydrate them, they get better. You don't need to do anything else.
I can do the pulse ox later. I can do it now, whatever you want me to do.
No, go ahead and talk about
Keep
pulse
talking.
Ox.
All right. So the pulse ox, you get a pulse ox on a kid with methemoglobinemia, and the pulse ox comes back at 90. What does that mean? The pulse oximeter doesn't know what to do with methemoglobin. When you do a pulse oximeter, you got the light on one side, and then you got the sensor on the other side, right? The pulse oximeter is only taught to read oxygenated hemoglobin and deoxygenated hemoglobin. It has no idea what to do with methemoglobin. When it's doing this, when it's reading it, what it's reading is the fact that deoxygenated hemoglobin at one wavelength, there are two wavelengths that are in this thing. At one of those two wavelengths, deoxygenated hemoglobin absorbs a certain amount of light, leaving whatever's left on the other end to sense. And oxygenated hemoglobin absorbs a different amount. And so they have these two wavelengths, and basically the thing is just programmed to say, okay, if this much light is absorbed at this wavelength versus this wavelength, then this amount of oxygenated hemoglobin to this amount of deoxygenated hemoglobin gives you a hemoglobin saturation of X. Well, since at one of those wavelengths, methemoglobin looks like oxygenated hemoglobin, and at the other of those two wavelengths, methemoglobin actually looks more like deoxygenated hemoglobin. I don't know if you're following. Are you with me? I don't even know if you're with me, but I'll keep talking. All right. All right. So the bottom line is The coaxometer is, or the pulse ox, not the coaxometer, the pulse ox is like, I don't know, am I deoxygenated? Am I oxygenated? I'll just pick something in the middle, and that's what it does. So you'll actually never see, even if somebody is 100% met hemoglobin, you will never see a pulse ox that'll be below, I think the number is like 76 or 86. I can't remember. It's like, do you remember something?
I thought it was mid-80s.
But it's relatively, it's like 70s, 80s. You'll never see it any lower than that. Because at one of those wavelengths, it looks a little bit like oxygenated hemoglobin. I'll stop talking.
All right, that's awesome. Dr. Cho, can you talk about household electrical burns in terms of what do they need? Do they need EKGs? Do they need any kind of formal workups?
So for the recommendation for household electrical burns is that they don't need those. They don't need an EKG. They just need local care. Now, if you look at the literature, if there were some suggestive things on history of physical exam that might make you concerned that this was something potentially that was deeper, or, for example, like I said, if there was wet skin, if there was a history of tetany with that electrical burn, if there was loss of consciousness, then I wouldn't say that it would be a bad thing to do an EKG, but just routine electrical household burns, that's not the recommendation.
Okay, awesome. We have a question here for Dr. Nelson. Can you talk a little bit about scorpion stings? Do they need an antivenom? Do they need just a warm hug?
Both will be helpful. Scorpions are a problem in Arizona. They're actually a much bigger problem. That's the northern end of their range. I mean, they're a much bigger problem in Mexico and Central America, but Mexico especially so. There's 8,000 scorpion bites in Arizona a year. There's 250,000 scorpion bites in Mexico each year. So in 2012, a Mexican pharmaceutical company introduced a safe and effective scorpion antivenom whose brand name I forget, but it's the scorpion antivenom. And it is useful. Scorpion bites, especially in children, because they have a higher, dose per weight injected, these kids are not happy. They have muscle rigidity. They have pain. They can get pulmonary edema. They often wind up in the ICU. The use of the antivenom has been a little controversial because it costs $100 a vial in Mexico and like $5,000 a vial here in the United States. So when they started using it, there were stories in the news of people getting, an $82,000 bill from a hospital, $80,000 of which was for the antivenom and, X number of vials of it, and $2,000 was for everything else. And since then, the price has come down, but it is still a pricey antivenom, but it is an effective antivenom. So, the price is still like $8,000 at some hospitals. Children's hospitals are always more expensive, so it's like $20,000 at Phoenix Children's. But it is an effective antivenom, and basically if you have a young enough kid who's sick enough, you should use it because it will definitely shorten their length of stay and decrease the likelihood they'll wind up in the ICU. But compared to the U.S. and Mexico, they got to be giving scorpions out in the Happy Meals at McDonald's. I mean, that's how common scorpion bites are there. So it's good. It's good that it's far less expensive in Mexico. Oh, right. Not all scorpions are poisonous. There's lots of non-poisonous varieties and lots of things that look like scorpions. So, just having a scorpion sting shouldn't merit the use of the antivenom. You have to be getting real sick from it any more than if someone comes in asymptomatic and says they were bit by a snake. You don't automatically start giving them the Crofab antivenom. That's an excellent point.
I think that trying to find the differentiation, you put up the slide about the non-venomous and the venomous snake. I'm not sticking around. Do you have caudal tail? I don't want to know. I'm done. I get that phone, I get the car keys, and I'm out.
Well, sometimes they bring the snake into the ER.
Right.
We've had live snakes brought into the ER. Right. We've had live ones. We've had dead ones. Don't forget the dead snakes, or especially when they cut off the head. Try not to put your finger near the mouth because the snake actually can reflexively bite for a while after it's dead. But, that's always real popular in the ER when they bring the snake.
I can tell you, if you do want to examine it for show and tell, what you can do is, because I can't get anywhere near it. So if you put it in a, those suction catheters that have a cap, if you can get someone crazy enough to actually take it from whatever it was in to put it in kind of sort of one of those, you can actually examine it and do a little.
Yeah, like an 8-year-old boy.
If you're crazy.
An 8-year-old boy would do that. Okay.
I'm only saying because I did it once and it, because I, and I, you know, basically I was trying to, they're like, can you identify this thing? They had brought it in a cooler and I'm like, I'm not touching that sucker. And the nurse is like, I'll take care of it. And she puts it in one of these things. So she brings it out and I'm looking at it and I'm trying to explain, okay, there's a sub, you know, the single and the double roll of subcaudal scales and the triangular head. Anyway, I go to look at this, I go to show them the bottom of the snake. I turn the thing upside down. The snake, of course, goes, you know, gravity, goes bam, scares a little bit of daylights out of me. I throw the snake. Anyway.
Did it open?
It didn't open, but.
Okay, so now for my talk, I got a what not to do slide.
Exactly.
Okay. I know, but families expect you to be able to identify all sorts of things. You're supposed to look at this thing and say, oh, yeah, that's Ed. I know that snake. But, yeah. So they bring them in. That's a good container to put them in. And it is actually very helpful. And you can, if needed, there's no HIPAA rule for snakes. So you can actually photo, if you have the snake, okay, and if they're in the, someone actually asked me, sorry, haven't asked me yet, but what, is it true you can't do anything about snakes
right
before you get to the hospital?
Right.
And one of the things you can do is photograph the snake if you have the snake out right there and you don't want to pick it up because, you know, because it's smart not to pick up venomous snakes. You can photograph them, and actually we've had families come in, just like they come in with pictures, you know, on their phone. Is this a seizure? They come in with a picture of the snake, and we've forwarded them to the Poison Control Center for identification. So that's good. And as long as we're on that question, you know, when EMS brings a kid with a snake bite in, I never mind if they put in a line and start fluids. I mean, it's not true you can't do anything. It's just very hard for you as a parent, let's say, to do anything for a snake bite in the field. So
excellent. All right. So we got through a few questions there. Dr. Cho, can you talk about the hypothermic patient, less than 32, less than, let's say, even 30? Are we... Before we start rewarming them, obviously, or while we're rewarming them, are we performing CPR? Are we attempting any kind of monitoring, defibrillation? Will there be any electrical signs on EKG?
So the recommendation is not to be attempting defibrillation until they are 30 degrees. So I think it's hard not to do CPR when they are asystolic in front of you. I mean, I don't think there's a study that I know of out there that says you don't need to do CPR until 30 and they'll be just as fine, because probably there's not a study to do that. So I would recommend continuing to do CPR while you're doing active rewarming, and then you can start to use medications and defibrillation after they're 30 degrees.
Excellent.
But remember, the song for CPR is Staying Alive by the Bee Gees.
Yes,
that's
right.
Actually...
And Dr. Nelson will now perform that for you.
No. I didn't want you to sing the Let It Go song.
Yeah, don't sing
CPR.
That. That's too slow.
No one's making it, okay? It was a wonderful song, but you got to do Staying Alive by the Bee Gees when you're doing CPR.
So does anyone know the original song that the AHA was going to go with before Staying Alive?
I do not.
Another One Bites the Dust. They thought maybe not the most appropriate theme to go with, so they changed it to disco, and disco, of course, is saving lives everywhere.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
Excellent.
Oh God, for the beaches.
All right.
Okay.
Dr. Anderson, is one application of Bengay equivalent to 1,700 milligrams of aspirin, or is that solely related to oil of wintergreen?
So 1 ounce of Bengay is, so that a typical tube of Bengay, I think, is about 4 ounces, I think. Is it three? Okay, so 3 ounces. So 1 ounce is like a third of it. So that 1 ounce is the 7 grams. I actually went looking to see before that case that, frankly, the only absorptive case that I've ever heard of was that one that I had on the listserv. I actively went looking for salicylism from topical Bengay. So generally, if you're putting it on non-intertriginous areas, like not the groin or the penis or behind the ear or under the armpits, generally absorption's not going to be huge. But if you do have those other areas, then you could do some damage.
Whoa, note to self.
Note to self when you're doing your Bengay.
And there was a case of the teenage girl runner athlete that was applying a bunch of Bengay, and there was great questions about whether she... past related to the salicylism or not?
Yeah. Okay. But whether or not they'll actually get toxic and be dead, I haven't been able, I haven't found anybody who's actually gotten sick from it other than that kid who put it on his penis.
Sure. Let's not talk about that any further.
Sorry.
All right. Dr. Cho, can you talk about the difference between the energy related to a lightning strike as opposed to potentially a high voltage? Is there a difference in terms of the mechanism that it affects you? Is there a difference in terms of how it courses through the body as we talk about, you know, an out looking for the...
I see. So lightning, they're saying the kind of thought is that it actually is kind of coursing over as opposed to... it could certainly cause internal damage, but a lot of it is coursing over you, whereas the direct current may be not only throwing you but kind of coursing through you. Lightning can also do that as well, so I wouldn't say that one is, like, hard and fast for, like, it's a typical scenario for both. I mean, they're both high voltage. For both of them, you're worrying about both internal as well as external and cardiac issues.
Okay. Dr. Nelson, can you comment on the use of oral steroids after a patient presents with urticaria alone as opposed to full-on anaphylaxis? Does a single urticaria or you know, a patient who presents with a mild allergic reaction, does that warrant steroids?
So milder allergic reactions to stings or almost anything else, you know, your mainstay of treatment is usually antihistamines such as diphenhydramine. Certainly if the placebo effect has been lost with diphenhydramine, you move on to Atarax, which is hydroxyzine, which has an extremely similar mechanism, but oh my God, this is so much stronger and better than Benadryl, you have no idea. Yes, I will actually use steroids for some particularly bad allergic reactions and hives. Particularly, I've had kids where either because they're stung on the face and they don't have cellulitis, but they're basically their eyes are swollen shut. So the two times I'm likely to give a kid a hit of Decadron, let's say, a long-acting steroid when they're in my ER, is if they have edema of an eyelid due to insect sting so that their eye is swollen shut, which means they're walking around with monocular vision. Those kids tend to bump into things, and they tend to fall down the stairs, and they come back with head trauma. So I'll use a dose of Decadron. There are also kids who, you know, there's kids who come in, they have hives, and they're fine. They're in front of you looking totally fine. But then there's kids who have hives who are really uncomfortable and cannot sit still and are itching like nuts. Those are the kids for just symptomatic relief, even though we know the hives are going to go away, I will treat with steroids more for comfort than anything else. So they're going to get some sleep tonight, and so their family gets some sleep that night. So I think it's a judgment call, and it depends on, again, on degree of eye swelling and just degree of patient discomfort. I think it's a fine thing to do.
Okay. Excellent. Dr. Cho, is there a specific CPK number that you would admit for rhabdomyolysis?
Oh, I apologize. I don't know if there's a specific number that I would actually think about.
I'm not aware of any number.
I mean, I think that obviously the higher you go, the more that you're concerned that there would actually be rhabdomyolysis and actual renal compromise. You're going to use your urine as a very important marker of whether there's just elevated CK or there's actually kind of some sort of ongoing kind of damage or kind of potential for damage. So if there's if you're having brown urine or myoglobin in the urine, that would be the kind of biggest concern for making sure you're aggressively hydrating. And I don't know the threshold for when that happens, so I can look into that. But I think that the higher the number, you're going to be more concerned that that would happen. And that's when you're really concerned is when you have the rhabdomyolysis as opposed to just the elevated CK.
So as all things in medicine, it seems like it's going to depend on the clinical scenario. It's going to depend on the ability for follow-up. It's going to depend on them following advice for significant hydration. I have certainly admitted for, I think it's, my number is kind of closer to 7,500 or higher, if all those things were otherwise good. And certainly if there's any bumps in the BUN and creatinine, that will certainly push
absolutely
me in the direction.
Absolutely. And I mean, if you're also thinking about this scenario, in this scenario that if you're talking about an electrical injury, I think you'd have kind of a lower threshold for having someone be observed if they had a bump in their CK because of it.
And the number may go up before it goes down.
Absolutely. And in fact, actually, I had one of my fellows who did he did an exercise tape that only took 90 minutes, But he did it twice in 24 hours, and he had a CPK. He did a shift with me. And I was like, what's wrong with you? You're really slowing down. He goes, I really don't feel good. And he had his CPK was in the hundreds of thousands and was admitted to our hospital for 3 days for hydration, but never had a BUN or creatinine rise during that time period. But yes, so he had a really good excuse for being a slacker that night. Dr. Nelson, can you talk about rabies immunoglobulin in terms of injection around potential affected sites? Yeah.
I wish we had fellows that did tapes like that, you know? That's not been one of our problems, having fellows that are too active.
This is so the reason.
I think that's a good problem.
My Olympic sport is actually sitting on the couch. That's I excel.
Yes, that's one of those problems you like to have. Injecting the rabies immune globulin, okay, you have to inject, you're supposed to inject about half in the wound, half right around the wound, and then you give the rest, you know, like you would a typical immunization. Now, the problem with having a wound on a finger is that it's very difficult physically to park that volume of rabies immune globulin around that wound. So in that case, just do the best you can. If you're given, if you got 3 cc's to get in the kid's body and you put 1 cc around a wound in something like a small child's finger and you give 2 cc's, you know, in another location, that's doing the best you can do. I mean, there's the recommendations from the vaccine manufacturer and then there's the reality of what you can do. So in that case, I think I'd just be sort of flexible. I'd still get the required amount in the child's body. You just can't put as much right, you know, in and around the wound like we like to do.
Right. Okay. Excellent. Dr. Anderson, related to acetaminophen toxicity, there's a question about when should we start using N-acetylcysteine? Is it just that time period that you indicated? Is it, can we go later than that? Can we go... What time frame should we start applying N-acetylcysteine?
Okay, I'm making the assumption that we're toxic.
Yes.
Right? Okay, so would I ever give it based on I just ate 17 or, you know, 37,000 grams of Tylenol, do I want to hurry up and give it then before I have an actual level? No. You wait your 4 hours, you get your level. If it's too high, then you give it. Ideally, you'd like to give it within the first 8 to 10 hours. Will I give it later? Yeah, I'll give it actually even up to 24 hours. There's some thought that even later out, N-acetylcysteine can actually even cause some even later than 24 hours out, N-acetylcysteine may be able to give you some neovascularization in the liver, still providing more glutathione for the liver. So will I still use it late? Yep. You know, if they don't come in until the next day, do I still try it? I might. But ideally, you would like to get it within the first 8 to 10 hours.
And there's a question here about the toxic dose. There's another book that's mentioned that says the toxic dose is greater than 200 per kilo, whereas in your talk, you talked about 150.
So, and that's true, actually. So it is an older recommendation for the 150. They give that recommendation of the 150 is based on whether or not your history is actually accurate. And so it's definitely a more conservative number to pick. But if you truly do know what it is, the actual, what we really do see is more than 200, particularly in kids. Kids in general tend to do better than adults. And the reason why kids tend to do better than adults, and they can actually take more, particularly if you're over, I think it's if you're under the age of 6 in particular, they do better because they have, I didn't show it, but Tylenol is metabolized in a couple of different pathways. One of them is the sulfonation pathway. And kids are very good at sulfonating acetaminophen. And the sulfonated form of acetaminophen is actually non-toxic. And they're better at doing that than we are. We kind of sort of glucuronidate, and that's okay, but this is even more better. So kids can tolerate those higher doses, that 200 per kilo. It's a very good point, whoever said it.
Okay. Dr. Cho, is there anything that distinguishes chilblain versus frostnip?
I don't know.
Right. I don't know either, to be honest with you. Although, again, chilblains.
It is confusing.
Awesome word.
Yeah.
Feel free to use it in your conversations later
use
today.
The term
I think, yeah, I think they often do, but it also is described as kind of a separate word entity, but they're very similar.
Right. They're synonyms. All right. And
Nelson says they're synonyms. They're exactly the same. I'll just go by whatever he says.
In terms of ticks, let's just talk about tick removal. Does anybody have some tricks of the trade? Talk about tick removal. Oh, clearly, this is a good one. Okay.
Oh, yeah, no, ticks. Ticks are fun.
Ticks are fun.
I have
I a favorite one.
This
you
kind
got
of tick?
A good tick thing?
No, okay.
Well, the key thing about ticks is that you don't remove them like you do the stingers, okay, because you don't want to, like, do the credit card trick or anything, because ticks, they really attach well to the body, okay, and you don't want to leave their mouth parts in. So you really do want to use tweezers and try to pull out the tick without leaving the mouth parts in. You don't do the same thing with a tick as you do with a stinger is my main advice. But, you know, Angie's got some great tick story that I want to hear.
Should I tell it?
All right. So what you do is if you're in the ED, you get some Zero Silk, you know, some, you know, the suture stuff. You get Zero Silk just because it's very strong. You make a loop, just like you were going to, like, tie a knot, right? You make a loop, and then you start to pull it. So now you've got, you know, you're starting to tie a knot. You've got a little loop. You're going to put the loop over the tick, and you hold it right down tight on the skin, right?
Where the mouth parts are attached,
right?
Yeah.
And then you, okay, you kind of sort of, like, strangle the poor little tick. But actually what happens is when you start to pull your knot taut, the little legs actually let go. I actually have a picture of one. It was really cool, right? The little legs let go, and now the key is, now that you've kind of sort of noosed your tick, instead of plucking the tick out vertically, you just want to pull it horizontally, and the sucker just pops right out. And I've done a bunch of them that way, and I even did one on a kid who was asleep, like never even woke up. It was like the greatest thing ever.
But
the mouth part just lets go, yeah. And I took a picture.
Yeah. That's key.
So you noose it. So you basically, if you've got the tick sitting here, you just want to tie your knot. I wish I had a string, but if I had a string, you just want to, you know, if the butt's sticking out, you're just trying to get as close to the base of it as you can.
So you're trying to get the string in between the body of the tick and the skin.
Exactly. So here's the tick. Here's the skin, all right? And basically, I'm going to try to get my string right up at the base here. And then just, zoop, got it? So then you pull it like this, you know, to tighten it. And then you just, and then the whole tick just whoop, comes right in.
You gotta love a woman who knows her vermin.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
I got that from
great.
I got
the strangest
got it
rodeo
from,
you've ever been to when you see Dr. Anderson pulling on ticks.
Whoa. How are
if
you
it is
bed
alive,
bugs?
Can I make anyway, a suggestion that if it is still alive, something viscous over it, Aralgan, something gooey,
viscous
and then an viscous lidocaine, yeah, and then an opsite, something that's occlusive. Walk away, go see the ankle in bed 5, and then come back after that, and more often than not, for me, it releases its grip, and you can just wipe the whole thing away. So I like that. I've used the lasso with less success than you. I clearly need more spurs on my feet here. Can she say one more thing?
Well, my sister's a pediatrician too. So my sister says she takes an alcohol swab, and she just goes around and around and around and around, and it comes out. I don't know.